From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, the Black Friday protests roll out nationwide as campaigners call on Walmart to improve pay and conditions.
You know, they'd rather have the money go into the pockets of the Waltons, you know, one of the richest families in America, and their corporate executives than into the pockets of the folks who are actually running the stores on the same day.
We have the latest on the ongoing tensions over the East China Sea air defence zone. We also take an alternative look at Iran's online reality. Our Colorado correspondent tells us about the scrutiny facing school security, and we find out why the Chinese are willing to pay millions of dollars for British pigeons.
Just over 500 pigeons were sold for 5.7 million euros, of which Chinese purchasers purchased 7 of the most expensive top 10 pigeons.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. China says it has sent warplanes into its newly declared air defense zone over the East China Sea, days after the U.S., South Korea, and Japan defied Beijing's unilaterally imposed flight rules. China insists all planes using the self-declared zone must file flight plans and identify themselves or face military retaliation. Nina Maria Potts reports.
China says its Air Force sent several fighter jets and an early warning aircraft over the vast zone it's recently created over the East China Sea. Details over exactly when the warplanes were deployed are sketchy, nor does Chinese media say whether the fighter jets encountered any foreign military aircraft. The move comes days after the US, Japan, and South Korea said they'd sent military and Coast Guard flights through the zone without encountering Chinese resistance. A Chinese Air Force official was quoted as saying Beijing remains on high alert and ready to protect the country's airspace.
The U.S. government's renovated website for healthcare insurance is supposed to debut on December the 1st, but questions remain over whether all the fixes are in and whether the website, healthcare.gov, will this time work. Priscilla Huff has an update.
The biggest question for healthcare.gov is whether it can handle the traffic. The website where Americans can compare and purchase now required health insurance is supposed to be able to handle 50,000 users at the same time. Back in October, when it originally launched, the website's infrastructure collapsed under just 2,000 users. The second biggest question is, once Americans log on, can they actually purchase health insurance? If those enrollment figures begin to surge, once the technical problems are fixed, then the Obama administration may be out of the political doghouse following the disastrous rollout.
A Malian man who's alleged to have assassinated an American diplomat and 4 Saudi tourists has been recaptured after escaping from prison in June. Al-Hassan Ould Mohamed, also known as Chebani, was arrested by French soldiers in northern Mali on Tuesday. Lorna Shattuck has more.
Mali's chief prosecutor announced that Chebani was arrested with 3 other people, and the country's justice minister added that he was captured in a hideout between the cities of Gao and Kidal, following a tip-off from Niger security officials. He was among 22 prisoners who escaped from jail in Niger during an attack by suspected Islamist militants in June. He was serving a 20-year sentence there for the murder of 4 Saudi citizens who were on a hunting trip in 2009. The US then unsealed an indictment for his arrest, saying he was also wanted for murdering American diplomat William Baltimore. In September, it also announced a $20,000 reward for information leading to his capture.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The US government has been fighting civilian piracy in recent years, but now stands accused of piracy itself. It is set to pay $50 million to a Texan software firm following claims that the government stole thousands of copies of a logistical computer program. The firm, called Aptricity, created software that helps track the movement of people and supplies, a system that is helpful during disaster relief and military exercises. Argentinian authorities have rescued nearly 100 women who were forced into prostitution in Buenos Aires. Police have led 57 raids over the past 2 weeks, leading to 25 people arrested and 30 bars and establishments with revoked licenses. Officials say the majority of the women were trafficked in from Peru and Paraguay. And shoppers in the U.S. have gone into the traditional Black Friday frenzy, as the day after Thanksgiving is the biggest shopping day of the year, with retailers rolling out major discounts and extended shopping hours. Panamanian authorities have decided to release the North Korean ship they detained in July. Officials initially suspected it carried drugs, but their search revealed that it carried Cuban weapons being transported to North Korea. Andrea Arenas reports.
Panama's prosecutor, Nathaniel Murgas, said that the North Korean vessel is free to go but may not leave Panamanian territory without first paying a series of penalties and fines that it owes to the Panama Canal Authority. Murgas also told reporters that his office has not yet decided if the 35 crew members who are also detained will be set free. Panama Canal authorities seized the Chonchong gang in July after finding it carried Cuban weapons, including two fighter jets hidden beneath a shipment of sugar. Panama said the shipment violated an international arms embargo against North Korea. Havana and Pyongyang said that the weapons were outdated and that they were being sent to North Korea for repair.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. The annual Black Friday shopping frenzy has once again generated as much controversy as it has sales. Thousands of Walmart workers, backed by union support, protested at America's largest private employer for better wages and working conditions. Rallies made up of former and current Walmart employees took place at 1,500 sites across the U.S., and earlier I spoke to Respect D.C. Coalition member Mike Wilson, one of the organizers for today's action.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, our Walmart is the organization head for Respect Walmart, which is a group of Walmart associates, both current and former, who have been organizing for the past several years around the country. You know, it's grown quite large from, you know, a few hundred workers when it started, thousands now around the country. And, you know, today on Black Friday is the biggest shopping day of the year. It's a big day for Walmart, and, you know, Walmart employees and their community supporters, like our coalition, have been taking action. You know, last year there were big actions all across the country, and this year it's gotten even bigger. I think there's supposed to be actions at 1,500 stores, and so this morning we were out at a store in Alexandria, Virginia. A Walmart worker and eight supporters were arrested in a civil disobedience action outside the store, with, you know, hundreds of supporters there as well. And I know that there's been arrests from civil disobedience and actions at other stores in other states across the country.
And what can you tell us about the message that you're trying to get across? What aspect of Walmart's business are you trying to highlight here?
Well, we're really trying to highlight, I mean, it's really two things. One is that we want Walmart to start paying associates fairly. You know, there's been a lot out there recently about the fact that, you know, Walmart could pay a base wage of $25,000 a year to all of its associates without really affecting its bottom line very much. You know, and we think that is a fair thing that they should do. You know, we also really want them to stop retaliating against their associates who have stood up. You know, several folks have been fired. There's recently been the NLR, National Labor Relations Board, has recently decided to prosecute Walmart on some charges related to that. And, you know, I think that a lot of things that have come out in the press recently have shown that, you know, the company really needs to change. I mean, they were running a food drive in Ohio for employees because, you know, it just seems to be some sort of acknowledgement that they don't pay enough for folks to get by. And as I said, like the studies recently that have shown that they can afford to pay more, they just choose not to.
You mentioned a food drive for the Walmart employees. This is a seriously large corporation. You know, they're looking at $17 billion worth of profits alone this year. What's been the response from the bosses at Walmart to this protest movement?
Well, you know, I think that their sort of thing is, well, this is the way we do, this is our business model, this is the way we do things. And I think that, you know, but I think a lot of it's been undermined recently because I think there's been an assumption that, you know, they needed to pay these wages to keep the business model intact. You know, they would have to raise prices or, you know, change big things about the company if they were to pay fairly. But as I said, I mean, a lot of what's come out recently has shown that they could pay fair wages. We're not even talking about, you know, astronomically high amount. I mean, $25,000 a year isn't very much, especially in some parts of the country where, like here in D.C., where it's much more expensive to live. They're just choosing not to do it. You know, they'd rather have the money go into the pockets of the Waltons, you know, one of the richest families in America, and their corporate executives, than into the pockets of the folks who are actually running the stores on the day-to-day.
Mike Wilson from the Respect D.C. Coalition. This is FSN Reports. Now to the continuing tensions in the East China Sea. Beijing has announced that it scrambled fighter jets to monitor both American and Japanese planes after they flew into China's newly declared air defense zone, which covers territory claimed by China, Japan, and South Korea. China says any planes flying through the zone must file flight plans in advance and identify themselves or face defensive emergency measures. U.S. Vice President Joe Biden sets off on a long-planned trip to the region next week, so FSN's Daniel Rinches spoke to Dr. Jonathan Polak, director of the China Center at the Brookings Institution, and asked him how much of a diplomatic challenge the vice president's facing.
Even if it looks inauspicious, this is exactly the time that you would wish a senior American official to be visiting these countries, simply because the United States cannot neglect the risks and, I believe, has to put forward in a more vigorous way its own statements of policy, its own sets of concerns with each of these critical actors.
Let's start then with China. They've come out of the third plenum with some significant new reform policies, which could be of benefit to the Americans. Can you sort of give us the overview on that?
I might characterize this as reform goals rather than policies, although we can see a few that already seem to be taking shape, because the fundamental phrase is the presumption that the market will play a decisive role in China's future economic development. That has implications not only within China, but for the kind of trade and investment relationship that presumably China would like to build with the United States and with others. So whereas I suppose several weeks ago, had Vice President Biden been going to China and elsewhere then, the focus would not be shifting as much towards some of these near-term security concerns. Necessarily, I think the Vice President will want to hear from President Xi Jinping on his own judgments about where China may head, how it's going to get there, and also what that would require or enable between the two countries if we are going to find a way to put the trade and investment relationship on a different level.
On the factor of this new zone that the Chinese have declared, what kind of knowledge does the United States not yet have about what the Chinese are intending to do with this zone?
I think that the biggest uncertainty is I'm not sure that the Chinese themselves know what to do with this zone. It's not even clear how fully this decision was coordinated across relevant Chinese bureaucracies. Interestingly, it was announced over a weekend, not in the usual times when we would have anticipated a decision like this. And we see every day modifications, variations, elaborations of what I'll call a what-if sort, because by declaring this zone and by opening up a range of possibilities, in essence saying it is within China's sovereign right to oversee air traffic, who's coming in and so forth, who's transiting this zone, you really change the equation depending on how China plans to implement these policies. And for that, we really don't know. I think Vice President Biden will be seeking clarification wherever he can get it from the Chinese side, because although it is certainly within China's sovereign rights to make these kinds of declarations, many other states have done them already. These claims do exist. What makes this so fraught with potential danger and risk is that much of the declared zone overlaps with Japan's declared air zone, and even to a limited extent with those of the Republic of Korea.
Can Joe Biden in any way try to mitigate some of those risks and talk to the parties in a sensitive way, or does he just stay out of it?
I don't see how he can. This involves palpable tensions and risks, not only between China and Japan, but between Japan and Korea. So you have a situation that is very psychologically unhealthy, damages American interests. There's no way that the vice president can just sort of sit on the sidelines on that. He has to come prepared
FSN's Daniel Rinches speaking to Dr. Jonathan Pollock. Now, the head of the UN's nuclear agency warned on Thursday that it will take some time before work can begin on verifying whether Iran is complying with a deal on its nuclear program. That comes after Tehran agreed last week in Geneva to curb some of that program for 6 months, a deal that didn't go down well in Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the agreement an historic mistake, and it seems some pro-Jewish groups and congressmen here in the US are inclined to agree. Lorna Shaddick reports.
After long late-night discussions in Geneva and several last-minute requests to change the text, the Iranians and six Western powers managed to strike a deal. For the first time in over a decade, Tehran agreed to freeze certain key parts of its nuclear program in return for $7 billion worth of sanctions relief. A tired but delighted US Secretary of State John Kerry said the region would be safer as a result.
This first step actually rolls back the program from where it is today. It will make our partners in the region safer. It will make our ally, Israel, safer.
But that ally didn't seem to agree, as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made clear on Sunday morning in no uncertain terms.
This agreement has made the world a much more dangerous place. I know that many share the concern of Israel, especially in the region.
The agreement means Iran's centrifuges will stop spinning over the next 6 months as talks on a more comprehensive agreement continue. But Mr. Netanyahu's fears that the deal was a mistake are shared by some congressmen in the US, Democrat and Republican. They don't like to see the White House angering Israel. Senator Bob Corker, a Tennessee Republican, accused the Obama administration of offering too many concessions to the Iranians.
They see this as their window of opportunity to negotiate with an administration that has shown that it really doesn't have a lot of the intestinal fortitude that other administrations have had.
Bipartisan groups in Congress are now pushing for more sanctions to be imposed on Tehran. Some want them in the next 6 months. Others if Iran fails to agree to a longer-term deal during that time. Either could derail the negotiations. But many pro-Israel groups in the US support that stance, concerned that after perceived foreign policy fumbles earlier this year in Egypt and Syria, the Obama administration just isn't taking Israeli interests into account. Shoshana Bryan is Senior Director of the Jewish Policy Center.
The American Jewish community, by and large, feels that this administration has taken a step that is potentially extremely dangerous for Israel, and at the same time has taken that step not in concert with Israel, but without Israel.
But not all Jewish Americans agree. Some say the deal with Iran heralds a better relationship between Washington and Tel Aviv, because ultimately they both want the same thing. Joel Rubin, Director of Policy and Government Affairs at the Plowshares Fund, thinks in the long term this will be a win for Obama and for Israel.
If anything, it's going to see and mean more American-Israeli cooperation and coordination in the days ahead. And American Jews poll consistently high in favor of diplomacy over war when it comes to Iran, 62% versus 38% in a recent American Jewish Committee survey. The key now on these Iran negotiations is to show that the administration is actually achieving the objective of preventing Iran from getting a bomb.
That key objective will be to the forefront of the negotiations taking place over the next 6 months. In the meantime, having worked hard to come up with an initial agreement in Geneva, the Obama administration now needs to work even harder at selling one back at home. Lorna Shaddick, Washington.
Well, although finding common ground between America and Iran may not be easy, it seems the Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, may actually have taken some inspiration from President Obama in his use of social media. Mr. Rouhani has just released a video similar to the Yes We Can film made by the Obama campaign. It was posted online, yet websites like Twitter and Facebook are banned in Iran. FSN's Kate Fisher has been speaking to Babak Rahimi, Associate Professor of Communication, Culture and Religion at the University of California.
It's hypocritical, but I think it probably underlines a double-sidedness to Iranian public life to begin with. There are certain things that they're not allowed to say, but nevertheless they do it anyway. You'll be surprised how many times the word and the term Facebook is used in everyday culture of Iran while the Facebook site is actually blocked by the Iranian state. Many Iranian state officials use Facebook or even talk about Facebook in print media. This last summer, I went to a play that was about Facebook in Iran. You could see how many of the Iranians are going to this play, this theatrical play. They're laughing about a story about Facebook, and at the same time, legally, they're not able to actually go online, go on Facebook. So this is just one of those twists and ironies of Iranian society right now.
Do the population not think, hang on a minute, we're not allowed to officially access these websites, yet our leader is actively using them?
Rouhani promised before coming to office that he's going to do his best to get rid of this Facebook censorship. And not just Facebook censorship, but various different kind of internet censorships. So he promised that, and he apparently has called for a committee to come and do away with these this regime of blockage, internet blockage. But obviously, Iranian state is not monolithic. There are different factions fighting. And one of the powerful factions in the Iranian government simply refuses to accept Rouhani's initiative to unblock internet or various different kind of internet sites.
How important do you think it was in the recent elections?
It was a huge, it played a huge role. Mr. Rouhani, the current president of Iran, his campaign, before he got elected to office, his campaign had an internet a team that was supposed to post certain videos, certain messages online, and make sure these messages are being shared throughout the social media landscape by, you know, ordinary Iranians. So given the fact that there is this internet team within the Rouhani's campaign shows how much the Iranian party politics or Iranian electoral politics has recognized the importance of internet. I mean, you know, it realizes that it's one of the best ways and perhaps the cheapest ways to get in touch with the Iranian population. But I think this video just really underlines the way in which Iranian politics is increasingly becoming digitized. And it's not just about Iranian politics. Global politics is increasingly becoming digitized. And if you take a look at this particular video that was posted by the Rouhani campaign, the president of Iran, this video very much resembles a similar video that was made by the Obama campaign. And Obama, you'll be surprised, is actually a model for many of these campaigners within the Iranian political system.
FSN's Kate Fisher speaking to Babak Rahimi. Now, nearly 90% of US school districts have made changes to their security policies since the shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut last year. That's according to Campus Safety magazine. School security has been a top priority across the US since the 1999 shooting at Columbine High School in Jefferson County, Colorado. FSN's Mary McCarthy met with Dr. John Nicoletti, a Denver-based psychologist who's been dealing with school security issues since that tragedy. He said in most places, students and staff are now taught fine-tuned procedures in preparation for a potential shooter situation.
Security, you really break down to two things. One is the physical, you know, the building itself and locked doors, those types of things. The other is just kind of what we call the psychology, and that's awareness and being able to identify individuals that prove to be a risk, identifying them earlier so they can disrupt the behavior. There are two type of attackers. There's an insider and an outsider. So an insider is somebody that's on the radar of the school. And an outsider would be like what happened in Newtown. This individual wasn't on the radar, so it's not like they had any pre-warnings. So school districts, there's enough best practices now that you really shouldn't have an attack from an insider.
I guess you're referring to students who might be having mental or behavioral issues who could pose a threat.
Yeah, again, one of the big things we see that leads to an attack behavior is a student starts kind of making threats, basically, and become fantasizing with attack behavior. So one of the best countermeasures would be what schools refer to as TVAT, or Threat and Violence Assessment Team, or, you know, crisis response teams, things that have the key stakeholders from the school district get together and look at all cases where there's a student of concern.
What would you say have been the biggest things that have changed since Columbine when it comes to school security?
Well, I think some of the biggest things in terms of the psychological end is if somebody broadcasts they're about to do something, people are believing it rather than saying, oh, that's just a phase he's going through, or he's just blowing off steam, or she's doing, you know, they take it seriously, and all these things are investigated. So that's from the psychological. And from the kind of physical facility security end, I think what we call target hardening, where you're looking at maybe we need to lock doors and make sure people don't tailgate, those type of things.
I know from speaking to security experts within schools here in Colorado that the drills or the awareness that they try to instill in students starts really young, even at the pre-K age. So is that something, too, that is creating fear within students?
Fear only comes about when somebody tells you there's a boogeyman, but they don't tell you what to do. like here in Jeffco, they have lockdowns for kindergarten, first grade, all grade levels, and kids respond well. I mean, it's no different than fire drills. Kids don't get fearful with fire drills. It just becomes a part of their culture. You know, in a school, your best detectors will be your students because they're the ones that are going to pick it up. So it's important that school districts train the kids on what to look for and what to do when they see something.
For young people who, a year ago, you know, whether they're living in Colorado or California or Connecticut, they heard what happened in Newtown. That affects them when they go to school the next day.
Actually, what it winds up affecting more than the kids are the parents. Because what it does is shatter the parent's assumption. Because as a parent, you have an assumption when you send your kids or your little ones to school in the morning, they'll come back alive. Then you have a shooting like that where children didn't come back alive. So as a parent, that shatters your assumption about it can't happen here. So what a parent has to do is figure out a way to rebuild that so they feel comfortable letting their child go to school or daycare or whatever.
Dr. John Nicoletti. And finally, it was a sport which had its heyday in the UK back in the 60s, but now the Chinese are starting to buy British racing pigeons for tens of thousands of dollars. Pigeon racing officials in Britain are seeing a big rise in Chinese pigeon fanciers wanting to snap up British birds, considered to be some of the best in the world. Our UK correspondent Dan Whitehead has the story.
The British racing pigeon is not the first thing that springs to mind as being the latest status symbol for the Chinese middle classes. But the birds are becoming big business in China, with the British-bred pigeons selling for thousands of dollars. In a back garden in the London suburbs, one of the UK's top pigeon fanciers, Brian Woodhouse, keeps more than 150 British racing pigeons and has even had Chinese people interested in the sport to visit.
The last Chinese people we had here were explaining over the last 15 to 20 years, it's got so popular with people over there now and that their lifestyle has changed, that they're looking for interesting sport, the interest of allowing a wild pigeon to fly away and then to fly around and come back to you and you control it basically, I think is of great interest to them.
And fanciers like Brian are cottoning on to the high interest coming from the Far East. Chun Ling introduces Chinese wanting to snap up the best British birds with sellers in the UK.
The Chinese fanciers now, lots of, they are very, very wealthy and also they like keep birds, they like keep this habit, they like keep good birds, especially I think UK channel pigeons.
The number of fanciers in the UK is declining at a rapid rate of around 5% a year, down to around 45,000, compared to 300,000 currently in China. Stuart Wardrop from the Royal Pigeon Racing Association hopes the big money being spent on UK birds will change the sport's fortune.
The most recent example was a large auction held in April of this year, where just over 500 pigeons were sold for 5.7 million euros. Of which Chinese purchasers purchased seven of the most expensive top 10 pigeons.
Sellers in the UK have started to translate their websites into Mandarin to keep up with demand from China, a country which could ensure the survival of this very British sport. Dan Whitehead, London.
And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the show by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Kate Fisher and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.